heartwood, radiates a network of ray cells that bring cool xylem and sweet phloem to the cambium layer on the periphery. The cambium layer manufactures the living sheath that rests just below the bark. A tree grows by producing one new sheath after another. When a sheath is outgrown, its woody skeleton is left behind, progressively forming the rings that we can see in cross-section after a tree is felled. A tree's wood is also its memoir. We can count the rings to learn the tree's age, for every season of growth requires a new sheath from the cambium. There's a lot of additional information written into tree rings, but it is coded within a language that scientists don't speak fluently yet. An unusually thick ring could signify a good year, with lots of growth. Or it could be just the product of adolescence, a random spurt of growth hormones cued by an influx of unfamiliar pollen from a distant source. A ring that is thick on one side of the tree, but thin on the other, tells the story of a fallen branch. When a branch is lost, it upsets the balance of the tree, triggering cells within the trunk to reinforce the side that must now support the newly uneven burden of the crown. For trees, losing limbs is the rule, not the exception. The vast majority of branches that any tree produces are severed before they become large, usually by external forces like wind, lightning, or just plain old gravity. Misfortunes that cannot be prevented must be endured, and trees possess a ready strategy. Within a year after the loss, the cambium will cast a healthy new sheath fully over the broken base of what used to be the branch, and then layer upon it year after year until no scar is visible at the surface. In the city of Honolulu, just where Manoa Road crosses Oahu Avenue, there stands a gigantic monkey pod tree, Pithecholobium saman. The trunk of this tree is 50 feet tall, and its branches form a giant arch that spans clear across the busy intersection. Wild orchids grow on the branches. They sit in companionable bunches, shaped like pineapple tops, and their naked roots dangle down beneath them. Feral parrots hop from one orchid to another, flapping their lemon-lime wings and squawking abuse at the pedestrians below. The monkey pod, like many trees of the tropics, lives in eternal bloom. Great globs of silky, thread-like pink and yellow petals rain down on the tourists, who pause to take a picture of the tree as they make their way up the valley to visit the famous Manoa waterfalls. On coffee tables all over the world, you can find photo albums containing photographs of the monkey pod tree at Manoa Road and Oahu Avenue. Thousands of worm's eye views of its magnificent 8,000 square foot canopy woven through with flowers. From the tourist's perspective, this tree has achieved its perfect form. They do not see a tree that is less than it might have been, or one that was forced to grow a different way after its limbs were torn. If the monkey pod tree at Manoa Road and Oahu Avenue were to be cut down, we could count the knots and see the buried scars of the hundreds of branches that it has lost during the last century of its life. But as of today, the tree stands, and while it is standing, we see only the branches that did grow, and do not miss the ones that were lost. Every piece of wood in your house, from the windowsills to the furniture to the rafters, was once part of a living being, thriving in the open and pulsing with sap. If you look at these wooden objects across the grain, you might be able to trace out the boundaries of a couple of rings. The delicate shape of those lines tells you the story of a couple of years. If you know how to listen, Each ring describes how the rain fell, and the wind blew, and the sun appeared every day at dawn. Chapter 10. The remainder of 1995 went by quickly. Once I had passed the prerequisite and grueling 3-hour oral exam that qualified me to write a dissertation, nothing was left but to write it. I did that quickly, indulging myself in long writing jags and typing with the TV on in order to supply the noise that I needed in order to focus past my loneliness. Soon after my thesis was written, I graduated. The 4 years that I had spent on my PhD seemed to have passed in the blink of an eye. Knowing that I'd have to be at least twice as proactive and strategic as my male counterparts, I had started applying for professor jobs during my 3rd year and had successfully secured an offer at a quickly growing state university, Georgia Tech. The next phase of my career was coming into focus, or so everyone kept telling me. In May 1996, Bill was awarded his bachelor's degree at the same ostentatious ceremony where I was awarded my doctorate. Neither one of us had any family in attendance, and so we found ourselves awkwardly shifting about on the sidelines while the other graduates were hugged and photographed, everyone beaming over their diplomas. After an hour of this, we agreed that no free glass of champagne was worth the torture, and we walked back to the lab. We took off our graduation robes, wadded them up, and threw them in a corner. Once we got our lab coats on, everything felt more normal. The night was still young. It was barely 9 o'clock, and prime working hours hadn't even started yet. We decided to spend the night blowing glass, which was our favorite late-night diversion. My goal was to seal a tiny amount of perfectly pure carbon dioxide gas into each of about 30 glass tubes. I would need them for reference when running the mass spectrometer. Each tube would provide a watermark of known value against which I could compare my unknown samples. Making these references was a time-consuming task that needed to be repeated approximately every 10 days. And like a lot of lab work that happens in the background, it wasn't very interesting. But at the same time, it was key that I do it carefully and without error. Bill sat nearby and performed the first step in the process by melting one end of a length of glass tube. In order to melt the glass, he was using a torch set to a small flame, powered by acetylene fuel and boosted by a stream of pure oxygen gas. It was like an entire barbecue grill on steroids, all blasting out of a single tiny opening. That was pointed away from his face, of course. The flame that emerges from this kind of torch is so bright that it will damage the human eye if you look directly at it, and so we were both wearing dark safety goggles. Glass is hard and brittle at room temperature, but it softens into luminescent toffee when heated to a few hundred degrees. Melted glass is hot enough to ignite paper or wood on contact. A drop of molten glass readily burns down through the skin if you spill it onto your arm, stopping only when cooled by a bone-deep rush of blood. University policy probably dictated that I shouldn't have been giving an undergraduate such a dangerous and advanced duty, but Bill had easily learned all the lesser jobs that I'd shown him, then proceeded to fix everything that was broken, and had finally gone on to perform preventative maintenance, all on his own initiative. He was simply running out of things to do, and I couldn't justify not letting him advance to more important tasks, so I taught him the basics of how to blow glass. While we worked during that night, I looked forward across my life and saw a future where I was making reference tubes weekly forevermore, shriveling up and turning gray while watching the dancing needle of a gauge, just like the one in front of me. The thought was depressing and comforting at the same time. I knew only one thing for certain, that I couldn't imagine any other future for myself. Snapping out of my daydream, I looked past the liquid nitrogen trap and toward the gauge. Its needle read flat, indicating that there was no gas left in the line. It had all condensed into my tube and was frozen inside the trap. I sealed the glass tube by melting it shut and then set it down such that the molten side would cool slowly while its frozen contents thawed. I looked over my shoulder to see Bill engrossed in producing tubes. "How about some radio?" I asked him conspiratorially, offering to break up the monotony with the rare treat of superfluous noise. As a rule, music is forbidden in the laboratory, especially during dangerous and painstaking work. We'd been trained to understand that you can't afford to have any part of your brain distracted from what you are doing, when each move you make is critical to both safety and success. "Yeah, sure," he agreed. "Anything except that NPR shit. I don't want to get all worked up over the plight of fishermen in some place that I can't even find on the map. I got my own problems right here." I thought I understood this remark, but I kept my mouth shut and did not comment. I had recently dropped Bill off in front of a dingy apartment complex on the border of what was known to be a crime-ridden neighborhood in Oakland. So while I was pretty sure that he wasn't actually homeless, I still suspected that it wasn't a good scene. For all the time that we spent together, Bill had mostly remained a mystery to me. I had been around him enough to know that he didn't do drugs, skip class, or litter on the street, incongruously enough, considering his disaffected comportment, but I didn't know anything beyond that. I took off my safety goggles, bent down behind the stereo, and began to search the frequencies, looking for an AM radio talk show that might entertain us for a while. The broken knob was not well engaged with the tuning mechanism, and so I had to fiddle with the dial in order to get it to move at all. The last thing I remember hearing clearly was an unbelievably loud, sharp pop, as if someone had set a firecracker off inside my head. After that, I didn't hear anything at all for about 5 minutes. Nothing. Not my own breathing. Not the buzzing of the building's airflow system. Not the whoosh of my blood pulsing through my head. Nothing. Terrified, I stood up and saw that the side of the lab where I had been working was now showered in splintered glass. I careened my head around and saw then that I was alone. Bill wasn't where he had been sitting. I panicked and yelled his name. When I didn't hear my own yell, my panic increased. Then I saw Bill's head slowly rising over the counter, looking at me with his eyes wide as saucers. When he'd heard what sounded like a gunshot at close range, he dove under a desk and remained crouched there until he heard me shouting his name. All at once it dawned on me what had gone wrong. I had condensed more carbon dioxide into that glass tube than I intended to. I had left it a minute too long while daydreaming, and far more gas had been trapped than the tube could hold. After I sealed the tube, the frozen gas had warmed up, expanding quickly and exploding like a pipe bomb. Moreover, it had exploded into Bill's stockpile of other glass tubes, shattering several days' worth of work and sending glass splinters flying throughout the room. Embedded in the back of the radio were hundreds of tiny shards of glass, and some not so tiny. The stereo had miraculously shielded my face from the explosion. Had I not been occupied in finding a station, the shower of glass would no doubt have hit me in my eyes. I was struck by the irrational fear that everything in the room might explode, and I looked around wildly, finally understanding that we were now safe, if only because all our glass was already broken. My hearing started to slowly come back, and with it came a mighty earache, which made every whispering sound burn the inside of my head as if my ear canals were raw and bleeding. "I cannot do this," I thought. And then, what the hell did I think I was doing here? I had fucked up. This was bad. Bill turned off the torches and then walked systematically around the room, unplugging everything. I stood there wondering what to do. I felt as if my whole world had exploded along with the tubes. Scientists don't do things like this. Fuck-ups do things like this, I thought. I couldn't even look Bill in the eye. Hey, can I take a cigarette break? Bill asked at length, with a surprising calm that served to make the whole thing even more unreal. I nodded, wincing. My ears hurt like crazy. Bill shuffled through the glass splinters that lay like hailstones all around us toward the door. When he got there, he stopped and turned around. You coming? He asked me. I don't smoke, I answered miserably. Bill jerked his head toward the hall. That's okay, he told me. I'll teach you. We went outside, walked a few blocks down Telegraph Avenue, and then sat down on the curb. Bill lit a cigarette, and we shivered in our t-shirts, queasy in the chilly Northern California night. The usual nocturnal characters who meandered around Berkeley were out, and we watched them walk by, some talking frantically to themselves. I drew my knees up to my chest and began to chew on the backs of my hands. It was a habit that I worked diligently to hide from other people. In the lab, I could usually just wear gloves, but at that moment, a great anxiety was overtaking me. I worked the knuckles of my right hand with my teeth until I felt the thin scabs open, and the taste of blood and the feeling of tearing skin began to calm me in a way that nothing else ever did. I ground my teeth into the raw skin between my knuckles, teething on my bones, sucking desperately for comfort. In a few short months, I would be a professor, but that night I was pretty sure I couldn't do anything. Bill took a drag. We used to have a dog that chewed her paws, he reflected. I know, it's gross, I said, flooded with shame. I doubled over my hands and pushed them into my stomach in an effort to keep them out of my mouth. No, he said. She was a great dog. We didn't give a damn. He continued. When you have a dog that good, you let it do whatever it wants. I rested my head on my knees with my eyes shut tight. We sat in silence while Bill smoked. At length, we walked back to the lab and swept up the glass, working carefully to hide all traces of what had happened. I was glad that it was the middle of the night, but felt guilty when it became clear that I was going to get away with such a serious mistake. Hey, what are you going to do next year? Do you know? I asked Bill as we swept. I had been unsurprised to learn that Bill had earned honors for his bachelor's degree in soil science, and I naturally assumed that he had some job lined up, as our department was known for its ability to place its graduates. My plan, explained Bill matter-of-factly, is to dig another hole in my parents' yard and move into it. I nodded in acknowledgement. And smoke, he said, until I run out of cigarettes. I nodded again. Then I guess I'll probably chew on my hands, he added with a shrug. I hesitated, and then I took the plunge. Listen, do you want to move to Atlanta and help me build a lab? I asked, and then added, I can pay you. Well, I'm pretty sure I can anyway. He thought for a while. Can we bring that radio? He asked, pointing at the shredded plastic stereo we were about to ditch in the dumpster out back. Yes, I said. We'll get a bunch of them. 2 months later, we loaded up all of our belongings, which fit easily into my pickup truck, and drove to Southern California, where I dropped Bill off with his family at his childhood home. We had agreed that I would move first, in time for the fall semester to start at Georgia Tech, and that he would join me a few months later. Bill's parents were extremely warm and friendly, generous and hospitable hosts, who from that first meeting treated me as a long-lost daughter. When I met him, Bill's dad was about 80 years old and had fascinating stories to tell, having worked his entire career as an independent filmmaker, documenting firsthand accounts of the Armenian genocide from which his family had fled when he was a boy. Supported in piecemeal fashion by the National Endowment for the Arts, Bill's whole family had worked to make these films happen, and Bill and his brothers had grown up serving as the film crew while hard traveling through Syria. In their family home near Hollywood, they edited footage in the studio and tended a huge garden. His dad could make anything grow, and his mom insisted that I eat only the oranges from their very best tree. On the final night of my visit, I lay on the bed in Bill's sister's bedroom, staring up at the ceiling and thinking about my future. The next morning, I would drive up to Barstow, merge onto Interstate 40, and leave California for good. It wasn't the first time that I would walk away from everything I knew and everything to which I'd become attached, knowing that I could never go back. It was the same way that I'd left home for college, and then left college for graduate school. Everyone but me was sure that I was ready to go. It was, however, the first time that I'd have a for sure friend at the place where I was going. And I knew enough to thank God for that. On August 1st, 1996, I officially became an assistant professor at Georgia Tech, and I was expected to look and act like one, even though I was only 26 years old and I had no concrete idea of how one does either of those things. There were many days when I'd spend 6 hours preparing a one-hour classroom lecture. Afterwards, I'd reward myself by sitting in my office, choosing and ordering chemicals and equipment, feeling like a giddy bride picking out her gift registry. When my purchases arrived, I piled them up in the basement, and soon they formed a mountain of cardboard boxes. The central mailroom had scrawled the word Jaren on each box when it was received, and it struck me as beautiful when I leaned against the wall and stared at the giant tower bearing my name lettered in 20 different hands. Bill was scheduled to arrive in January, and then we would begin to set everything right to make real the dreamscape that we had so often described to each other back in California. I didn't want to open any of the packages until we could do it together, but I was like a little kid waiting for Christmas morning. I would pick up a box, shake it, try to guess exactly what was inside, start to open it, restrain myself, and then return it to the pile. I taught geology to freshmen and geochemistry to juniors, and it was far more work than I had reckoned it would be. During that first semester, I think I made more mistakes on the homework than the students did. Eventually, I embraced the persona of the amiable, forgiving professor who was eager to give everyone an A. It suited me better than trying to be a hard ass, as I wasn't much older than most of the undergrads, and I was younger than many of the graduate students. For my part, I had never liked lecture courses anyway. Everything important that I had learned had come to me from working with my hands. Nevertheless, I dutifully fulfilled my lecturing obligations. I wrote equations on the chalkboard, assigned and graded homework, held office hours, and gave final exams. But I mostly focused on the coming new year, when Bill and I would start building my first ever all-my-own lab. On the day that Bill flew in, I drove to the Atlanta airport an hour early and then stood in the baggage area mesmerized by the circling carousels. Suddenly I heard a familiar voice. "Hey, Hope, over here." I turned and saw Bill standing 2 carousels over. He was burdened with 4 heavy suitcases of the old hard-sided kind without rollers or straps. "Oh, hi." I had been at the wrong baggage claim. Confused, I looked around me. I didn't remember checking the carousel number. I also didn't remember parking the car, and yet there I was, holding a ticket to the parking structure with the location C2 written on it in my own handwriting. This sort of thing was happening to me frequently. Snippets of time were lost here and there. And even as I compensated in order to hide it, it kept getting worse. I had even gone to see a doctor about it, who had examined me for all of 45 seconds, told me I was working too hard, and then wrote me a refillable prescription for a mild sedative. "You look different," said Bill. He was right. I wasn't sleeping much, and I had lost quite a bit of weight. I had always been high-strung, but this felt like something different. "I have anxiety. It's my new thing," I explained, opening my eyes very wide. "It affects more than 25 million Americans," I said, quoting the pamphlet that the doctor had given me.
"Okay."
Bill looked around and added, "So this is Atlanta. Jesus, what are we even doing here?"
"It's our last best hope for peace."
I quoted the opening lines of Babylon 5 in a deep science fiction narrator voice. I laughed at my joke, but Bill didn't. We walked across the skyway into the parking garage and found my car. Bill stuffed his belongings into the back and then slid into the passenger seat.
"I've never been this far east," he revealed. "They do sell cigarettes in these parts, don't they?"
I handed over the unopened pack of Marlboro Lights that had been in my purse for months. "Sorry, I haven't kept up with my practicing, but I am getting pretty good with these things." I showed him my prescription bottle of lorazepam, shaking it like a rattle.
"To each his own," muttered Bill.
He lit a cigarette, rolled down the window, and threw out the spent match. I inhaled his secondhand smoke and relaxed into its familiar smell. Bill was delighted to find that winter means very little in the South, and we drove with the windows down and without our seatbelts on, making our way inside the Beltway and toward the rising skyline of Atlanta. I felt the deep and simple happiness that comes from not being alone. After driving for a few more minutes, I realized that I didn't know where I was supposed to be taking Bill. That night, 2.5 years earlier, when we had returned from the field course and he was the last to be dropped off, came to mind. I offered,
"You know, you're welcome to crash on my couch for a while until you rent a place of your own."
"No, thanks. Just dump me downtown later and I'll figure it out," he said. "Right now, I want to see the new lab."
"Okie dokie," I agreed. "Let's go."
We drove to the university, and I parked outside of our building, which was known as Old Civil Engineering, even though the engineering department had long since relocated to better digs. I escorted Bill down the stairwell, into the basement, and to the room that would serve as our laboratory. I could barely contain my excitement as I turned the key and opened the door. Once I got the door open, however, it occurred to me that I had nothing much to show him. It was a windowless room, about 600 square feet, and when I looked at it through a visitor's eyes, I became aware of how little it resembled the glittering high-tech space that I had described to Bill during our many daydream sessions in California. I looked around the dingy little room that had been battered and then abandoned. The drywall was pockmarked and ripped in places. Light switches spilled out of gashes in the walls and dangled freely from their hasty wiring. The wiring of a splayed power outlet was unraveled near our feet. A layer of rusty mildew covered everything, including the fluorescent light tubes that flickered above our heads. All around the perimeter, where there should have been wainscoting, there was instead a long, dry smear of something that might once have been glue. The area near the chemical hood stank like rancid formaldehyde, which was a bad sign given that the sole purpose of a working chemical hood is to prevent one from breathing and thus smelling chemicals. Looking at Bill,
I felt a sudden urge to apologize for the inadequacy of it all. The tour was just getting started, and I was already ashamed that this was all I had to offer to someone who had moved so far away from home at my invitation. It was nothing like the lab where we had worked in Berkeley, and it clearly never could be. Bill removed his coat and threw it in a corner. He took a deep breath, ran both hands through the full length of his hair, and turned around slowly, counting the electrical outlets. He caught sight of the transformer and power conditioner that had been haphazardly installed in one corner of the room, complete with a bright red emergency power cutoff. He pointed at it and said, "Oh, this is great. This will give us a stable 220-volt supply. Exactly right for the mass spectrometer, just completely perfect," he added for emphasis. It was what it was, the first lab space to which we were the sole possessors of the key. It may have been a tiny hellhole, but it was ours. I marveled that Bill could see that gutted room, not in comparison with what we had always planned it would be, but for what it was, and for what hard work might make it into. Despite the large difference between past dreams and present reality, he was ready to love our new life. I made up my mind that I would try to love it too. Chapter 11. It's rare, but a single tree can be in two places at once. Two such trees can exist up to 1 mile apart, and yet still be the same organism. These trees are more similar than identical twins. In fact, they are identical without qualification, right down to each single gene. If you cut both trees down and count the rings, you will see that one of them is much younger than the other. When you sequence their DNA, however, you will find no differences. This is because they used to be parts of the same tree. It is easy to become besotted with a willow. The Rapunzel of the plant world, this tree appears as a graceful princess bowed down by her lush tresses, waiting on the riverbank for someone just like you to come along and keep her company. Don't be fooled into thinking that your fairy tale willow is special, however. Chances are that she is not. If you walk upstream, it is likely that you will find another willow tree. It is also likely that this tree will be precisely the same willow as your dear willow, standing in a different pose, with a different height and girth, and having perhaps seduced dozens of other princes over the years. A willow tree is far more like Cinderella than it is like Rapunzel, in that her lot in life involves working harder than her sisters. There's a famous study in which scientists compared the growth rates of a group of trees for a year. The hickory and buckeye were fast out of the gate, but then stopped growing after just a few weeks. The poplar made a good show and grew for 4 full months. But it was the willow that quietly outpaced all the others, continuing to grow for a full 6 months through the shortening days of autumn, and right up to winter's iron gates. The willow trees in the study grew an average of 4 feet by the end, almost double the growth of their nearest competitor. Light equals life for a plant. As a tree grows, its lower branches become obsolete, too shaded by the newer ones above to be of any further use. A willow tree loads these used branches with reserves, fattens and strengthens them, and then dehydrates their base such that they snap off cleanly and fall into the river. Carried away on the water, one out of millions of these sticks will wash up onto a bank and replant itself. And before long, that very same tree is now growing elsewhere. What was once a twig will be forced to function as a trunk, stranded under conditions it had never considered. Every willow tree features more than 10,000 such snap-off points. It sheds 10% of its branches in this way every single year. Over the decades, one, maybe two, of these will successfully take root downriver and grow into a genetically identical doppelganger. The oldest surviving family of plants on Earth is the Equisetum, the horsetail. The 15 or so species that persist today have known 395 million years of Earth's history. They saw the first trees scale the heavens. They saw the dinosaurs come and go. They saw the first flowers bloom and then swiftly overtake the Earth. There is a sterile hybrid horsetail, known as Ferrisii, that cannot reproduce, but can only spread like a willow, via parts breaking off and establishing elsewhere. Although ancient and impotent, Ferrisii can be found growing from California to Georgia. Did it cross the country like a newly minted PhD, moving to a sprawling technical university, and find magnolia trees and sweet tea and black humid nights loaded with fireflies and uncertainty? No. Equisetum ferrisii crossed the country like the living thing that it is, and found itself elsewhere, and then did the best that it could. Part 2. Wood and Knots. Chapter 1. The American South is a plant's idea of Eden. Summers are hot, but who cares, because the rain is generous and the sunshine predictable. Winters are more cool than cold, and freezing is rare. The heavy humidity that chokes us is like nectar to a plant. It allows it to relax and open its pores and to drink in the atmosphere, confident that evaporation will not interfere. Plants grow all over the South like nowhere else. Poplar, magnolia, oak, hickory, walnut, chestnut, beech, hemlock, maple, sycamore, sweet gum, dogwood, sassafras, elm, linden, and tupelo stand over a blanket of trillium. May apple, laurel, wild grapes, and woefully plentiful poison ivy. In this deciduous world, the mild winters are a leafless, lazy time that serves to heighten the drama of the spring explosion of growth. In February, the South begins to burst forth in a profusion of leaves, every single one of which will grow bigger, greener, and thicker through the long, busy summer. In the fall, copious fruit ripens and seeds are scattered, until finally all the leaves are shed in preparation for winter. If you rake fallen leaves into a pile and then examine them, you will see that each one shows a consummately clean break at the same place near the base of the stem. The fall of leaves is highly choreographed. First, the green pigments are pulled back behind the narrow row of cells marking the border between stem and branch. Then, on the mysteriously appointed day, this row of cells is dehydrated and becomes weak and brittle. The weight of the leaf is now sufficient to bend and snap it from the branch. It takes a tree only a week to discard its entire year's work, cast off like a dress barely worn but too unfashionable for further use. Can you imagine throwing away all of your possessions once a year because you are secure in your expectation that you will be able to replace them in a matter of weeks? These brave trees lay all of their earthly treasures on the soil, where moth and rust doth immediately corrupt. They know better than all the saints and martyrs put together exactly how to store next year's treasure in heaven, where the heart shall be also. Plants are not the only exploding growth in the American South. Between the years 1990 and 2000, the amount of total income tax collected annually by the state of Georgia more than doubled as Coca-Cola, AT&T, Delta Airlines, CNN, UPS, and thousands of other recognizable companies relocated themselves to the Atlanta area. Some of this new revenue was channeled into the universities in order to meet the educational needs of a larger and more corporate population. Academic buildings popped up like mushrooms. The number of faculty skyrocketed, and student enrollment continued to climb. In Atlanta during the 1990s, every kind of growth seemed possible. Chapter 2. Bill and I spent night after night of those first years designing and redesigning the first Jaren lab, the same way that a little girl never tires of dressing and redressing her favorite doll. First, we put up drywall and split the space into two rooms, each less than 300 square feet in area. Then we crammed them full to bursting with instrumentation, a mass spectrometer, an elemental analyzer, four vacuum lines. We refurbished the ventilation hood to make it capable of tolerating even that most dangerous acid, hydrofluoric. Bill custom carpentered space-saving compartments under each counter and inside each cabinet that allowed us to fit all of the things we needed and a lot more of what we didn't. We instinctively hoarded against hard times, which Bill was positive were already on the way. We went to the Salvation Army and got old camping equipment for the lab and amateur oil paintings for my office. We visited the state surplus warehouse, where anyone with a Georgia State employee ID card could help themselves to the mountain of outdated equipment that had been discarded by local government agencies. From there we came home with four 35mm film cameras, an inky mimeograph machine, and two police batons. If we were going to be scientists for 50 more years, we asked ourselves, who could know what might come in handy over such a time span? One night in early December of that first year, 1997, stands out in my memory, even though it was nearly identical to many other nights that had come before and would come after. "Season's greetings," I called out while entering the lab. "What's up?" Bill's head popped up from underneath the mass spectrometer. "The elf didn't come by today, if that's what you're asking." He shouted over the noise of the air compressor, which sounded for all the world like an old car with a bad starter. "That goddamn thing is going to make me deaf before my time." "Huh? What? Huh? Speak up," I answered. The elf was what we called the head graduate student within a huge and uber-busy lab located on the far side of the campus. Bill had christened the place Santa's Workshop because of its bizarre atmosphere. Upon entering, you were surrounded by buzzing students, each of them too preoccupied to even say hello. We ran many gas samples for them, which were delivered to us daily by the elf. "They expect us to work for free. They could at least stick to a schedule," I grumbled. Bill shrugged. "It's a busy time of year for the elf," he said, nodding toward the calendar. "Maybe his heart's not in his work. I've heard that he actually wants to be a dentist." I really wasn't too concerned. I had finally handed off the revised version of a manuscript to a co-author, and I was savoring its lifted weight. "Ready for lunch?" I asked cheerfully. "Sure, why not?" Bill accepted my invitation, and we relocated to the microscope lab. "It'll be my treat," he added. My 70-pound Chesapeake Bay retriever, Reba, stretched and got up from her basket in the corner. Pleased to see me, she ambled over with her bone, wagging her tail. "Hey, girl, you hungry?" I petted her, rubbing the sharp occipital bone on the top of her head that we referred to as the fin of the beast. While moving from California to Georgia, I'd gotten lost on the outskirts of Barstow while trying to get myself off of Interstate 15 and on to Interstate 40. Somewhere near Daggett Road, which runs north-south on the eastern side of Barstow, I'd stopped to ask for directions at a parked RV displaying the sign, puppies for sale. When I crouched down and asked the little pack of brown burr heads which one of them wanted to come to Atlanta with me, a gangly, brindled pup had stumbled over with a serious look in her eyes, and then tried to climb into my lap. $50 later, I knew it was meant to be because they took my check. She was my dog. Like me, Reba spent the best part of her puppyhood in the laboratory, sleeping under the benches and begging Bill to share his tuna fish on saltines dinners. The arrival of each new student spurred the same serious debate between me and Bill as to whether this new person could be anywhere near as smart as Reba. Reba always refused to weigh in, and we weren't sure if she was appalled at our unprofessionalism, or convinced that the comparison was facile, or perhaps both. I took out a small portable TV from one of the cupboards and moved three microscopes to the side, clearing a place for it. In a few minutes it would be 11 p.m. and Jerry Springer would be on. I put some popcorn in the microwave and cracked open two Diet Cokes. Bill entered carrying 9 frozen McDonald's cheeseburgers, 3 for me, 3 for him, and 3 for Reba. He had purchased 40 or so of them when the campus commons ran a 25-cent special, and we had happily discovered that their physical properties were not meaningfully changed when reheated from a frozen state. Bill and I had both left California fairly deep in debt, due to a series of dissimilar but equally foolish purchases from years ago, and had vowed to pay it all off as quickly as possible once we got real jobs. We soon found ourselves conducting a long-term experiment designed to measure how little we could spend each week and still get by, and frozen food had become a major component of our dietary intake. We ate in front of the TV, watching a man clad only in a diaper spiritedly invoke First Amendment protection for his adult baby lifestyle, waving his bottle for emphasis. "Man, I would do anything to get on Jerry's show," I said with a wistful longing.
"So you've mentioned," acknowledged Bill with his mouth full as we watched a montage of the man being changed and powdered by his sweetheart slash caregiver. When lunch was over, we cleaned up. "Hey, I've got a wacky idea," I volunteered. "Let's spend tonight running our own samples for a change."
Bill was game.
"Not so crazy, it just might work," he said. "But first there must be the airing of the beast."
We went outside and all three of us gazed up at the stars while Bill smoked a cigarette.
"This pack cost me more than $2, he complained. "I'm going to need a raise."
The entire geographical footprint of a college campus is illuminated all night every night, greatly enhancing its desolation during the weekend. During the school week, the university belongs to no one. It buzzes and throbs with people coming and going. But the whole place is different on Friday at midnight, when the university belongs to you. Smug in the presumption that you are the only working person within a 50-mile radius, you accomplish just enough to feel justified in being naughty. In the rhythm of these Friday nights beats the honest, humble heart of science, and it also explains how discovery and mischief are two sides of the very same coin. A tarnished penny half hidden by the dust of the gutter, I reflected while we were cleaning out the lint traps of the air compressor.
"A penny that will buy you a non-fat soy latte," added Bill, "after somebody loans you $3.84.
We had spent the week doing organic carbon extractions, which is a lot more fun than it sounds. For about 200 million years, dinosaurs roamed our planet in great groups, and a very tiny minority of them were preserved in the mud and silt of their time, including some locked away in Montana until a couple hundred years ago, when landowners stumbled upon them. Dinosaur bones have been carefully excavated, described in painful detail, prepared with special glues, shown to the public, and studied for posterity. Other, less charismatic fossils are of lesser value but potentially greater import, I would argue. Each streak of brown within each rock that houses a fossil might be the smeared residue of a plant that lived at the time and provided the food and oxygen that supported so many huge reptiles. In these smears, there is no anatomy, no morphology, and nothing to take a picture of or to display. However, we might harvest some chemical information from the smear if we could somehow isolate it and hold it up to the light. Living plants are distinct from the rocks that surround them in that they are rich in carbon. My colleagues and I decided that if we could capture and separate all the carbon within the dark smears inside the rocks that also held dinosaur fossils, we would have then laid claim to a new sort of plant fossil. The chemistry of this carbon might tell us something about the plant, even though we would never know the shape of the leaves that had made the smear. In order to liberate the organic carbon, and only the carbon, from a dead rock, we trap the gas that is released while the sample burns. When we do chemistry with liquids, we use beakers to hold one liquid and pour another, to mix the two and to keep others separate. To do chemistry with gases, we use a glass apparatus called a vacuum line, similar to the apparatus that I had been using when I caused the explosion years earlier. Working a vacuum line is rather like playing a church organ. Both have lots of levers to pull and knobs to twist, and it all has to be done in the right order and with the right timing. Both hands are moving at the same time, often performing dissimilar tasks, as the trap and the exhaust are operated independently. After a day of use, both the vacuum line and the organ must be lovingly shut down and delicately maintained. They can both be regarded as pieces of art in their own right. The biggest difference between the two, however, is that a church organ will not explode in your face if you make a mistake while using it.
Ugh, I hate that thing!
Bill had covered his ears after the loudest air compressor in the world started up with a phlegmatic mechanical cough.
I know, it's awful, I acknowledged, but a new one is $1,200.
Isn't there someone somewhere who owes us? He ventured.
Maybe you should write a Christmas letter to Santa.
You are a goddamn genius, I said, and I meant it. Bill was referring to our ever-increasing exploitation at the mittened hands of Professor Santa, the elf's boss, in which I was supremely complicit, having initiated the whole thing as a barefaced effort to ingratiate myself with an influential person. After reading some of this distinguished professor's publications about oxygen chemistry, I had offered to run some trial analyses of oxygen isotopes for free, and the project had snowballed from there. The puns practically wrote themselves that winter. After he deemed the data to be very interesting, and then redirected his whole workshop toward making additional samples. We naively consented to run them, vastly underestimating the number of oxygen reactions that could be carried out using a wooden mallet while standing at a conveyor belt and singing. Earlier that winter, I had gone to a lot of trouble writing multiple private emails to the elf, insisting that he implement a workshop-wide protocol requiring all samples to be labeled in either green or red ink and bundled in units of 10 using silver tape prior to delivery. My efforts paid off with interest once the sample tubes accumulated to the point where Bill had gotten the joke. When we inspected our sample logs, we estimated that user Rudolph had logged about 300 free analyses, knowing that they would cost $30 a pop if ordered commercially. We agreed that I would write a letter asking Dear Santa to bring us a shiny new silent air compressor. We envisioned ourselves coming downstairs on Christmas morning to find one adorned with a huge red bow, sitting just beneath the biological materials incinerator.
Start out by explaining how we've been very, very good all year, directed Bill.
You get the thesaurus, and I'll get the department letterhead. It has to be perfect. I was determined to wring as much fun out of the exercise as possible.
I wonder if they stock crayons in the front office, mused Bill.
While I was digging in my purse for the keys to the office supplies cabinet, I found a nearly full package of Razzles in one of the pockets, and I stopped in my tracks.
You'll never believe this, but the greatest thing in the history of the world has happened, I told him.
We put aside what we were doing, sat on the floor, and divided up the candies, fighting over the precious orange ones and automatically segregating the blue raspberry ones for Reba because they were her favorite. The 56 hours of weekend that rolled out before us seemed endless. At sunrise, we planned to declare ourselves the rightful inheritors of everything in the departmental refrigerator. But beyond that, we had nothing scheduled. Maybe we would pick the lock to the machine shop and gawk at the huge saws, drills, and welding tools, treating it as our own personal museum. Maybe we would stage a private showing of the seventh seal using the projection system in the main auditorium. And maybe there was someone somewhere in the world who was happier than I was during that year. But on nights like that, I certainly couldn't imagine it.
Chapter 3. Plants have far more enemies than can be counted. A green leaf is regarded by almost every living thing on earth as food. Whole trees can be eaten while they are only seeds, while they are only seedlings. A plant cannot run away from the endless legions of attackers that comprise an unremitting menace. Within the slime of the forest floor thrive opportunists that regard all plants, dead or alive, as nourishment. The fungi are perhaps the worst of these villains. White rot and black rot fungi are everywhere, so named because they have chemicals that can do what nothing else can. They can rot the hardest heart of a tree. 400 million years of wood, save a few fossil slivers, has decomposed back to the sky from whence it came. All this destruction can be attributed to a single group of fungi that makes its macabre living by rotting the ligneous limbs and stumps of a forest. Yet within this very same group are the best, and really only, friends that trees have ever had. You may think a mushroom is a fungus. This is exactly like believing that a penis is a man. Every toadstool, from the deliciously edible to the deathly poisonous, is merely a sex organ that is attached to something more whole, complex, and hidden. Underneath every mushroom is a web of stringy hyphae that may extend for kilometers, wrapping around countless clumps of soil and holding the landscape together. The ephemeral mushroom appears briefly above the surface, while the webbing that anchors it lives for years within a darker and richer world. A very small minority of these fungi, just 5,000 species, have strategically entered into a deep and enduring truce with plants. They cast their stringy webbing around and through the roots of trees, sharing the burden of drawing water into the trunk. They also mine the soil for rare metals, such as manganese, copper, and phosphorus, and then present them to the tree as precious gifts of the magi. The edge of a forest is a hostile no man's land, and trees do not grow outside of this boundary for a reason. Centimeters outside a forest's border, we find too little water, too little sun, too much wind, or too cold for just one more tree. And yet, though rarely, forests do expand and grow in area. Once within hundreds of years, a seedling will conquer this harsh space and endure the requisite years of want. Such seedlings are invariably heavily armored with a symbiotic below-ground fungus. So much is stacked against this little tree, although it does have twice the usual amount of root function, thanks to the fungus.